Thank you so much, Christopher, for that excellent discussion. I'm very pleased to introduce our next speaker, Cindy Ermes. Excuse me. Cindy is assistant professor of history at the University of Lethbridge, where she teaches courses on early modern Europe, the age of revolutions, and the history of disasters. She has published on catastrophe and crisis management in 18th century Europe and the Atlantic, and she is the editor of a forthcoming volume, Environmental Disaster in the Gulf South, Two Centuries of Catastrophe, Risk, and Resilience. Her current book project is a transnational study of the Plague of Provence of 1720, the Great Plague of Marseille, excuse me, one of the last outbreaks of plague in Western Europe. By tracing responses to the threat of infection throughout a network of major 18th century port cities, Cindy explores the ways in which the crisis influenced society, politics, and commerce beyond France, in neighboring regions, and in the Atlantic and Pacific colonies. You're also the co-founder and executive editor, and contributor at www.ageofrevolutions.com. Cindy's paper today is entitled Plague and the Port City, Movement and Migration During an 18th Century Crisis. Cindy.
Thank you so much. And thank you for including the plug for Age of Revolution.
All right. Chris, may I move this right to the table?
Yes,
is that okay?
Yeah, I can.
Awesome.
Great.
Cool. So thank you. Thank you so much for the lovely introduction, Chris, for organizing this terrific panel, Martha, for commenting. I should mention, in fact, that Chris has contributed one of the chapters to that volume on disasters in the Gulf South, so I'm excited about seeing it in print here soon. So disasters and dislocation, the subject of our session here, go hand in hand. Major crises, including so-called natural disasters, but also man-made disasters, war and revolution, for example, they can unleash movements and migrations at every step of their unfolding. Consider Hurricane Katrina. This great storm set in motion one of the largest American diasporas of recent times, initially reducing the population of New Orleans by more than half. 17 years later, the Crescent City's population is still only about 80% of what it was before Katrina. It's also worth noting that while we have yet to obtain reliable numbers, we should mention the hurricanes of the catastrophic 2017 season here. Harvey, Irma, Maria continues to unfold, and surely these events have, these extreme events have altered the population numbers across the Gulf South and the Caribbean Basin. More so than merely causing an exodus, however, historically, a disaster could even lead to the full relocation of an entire town. This, in fact, was among the first, often I should say, among the first options that officials would consider in the wake of major catastrophes. Guatemala City is a really good example because it was moved three times, interestingly. The first site had been attacked by natives. The second was devastated by a mudslide. The third was struck by three earthquakes in the 18th century, at which point finally the present-day location was chosen. So the relationship between disaster and migration is pretty clear. But I would argue that the relationship between migration and disaster, the disaster of disease in particular, epidemics, is perhaps much closer still. Not only do epidemics cause the movement of people who would traditionally flee to the countryside, as we'll see, for example, but consider, too, the role of migration in the very creation of epidemics and pandemics, which often result from the movement of people, animals, and products. Historically, an infectious agent could spread through trade or warfare, for example, and often enter through port cities, and few other crises, if any, though causing the movement of humans, are directly caused by their movement. Moreover, the relationship between movement and communicable disease is inherent in the very phrase itself, able to be transmitted from one person to another. The definition of communicable disease then fundamentally highlights the migratory essence of disease. In line, then, with the conference theme on diasporas, displacements, migrations, I'd like to use this as an opportunity to just kind of further explore these concepts of movements and networks within the context, though, of disaster studies. I'd also like to consider the restriction of movement in times of crisis. And to do so, I'll be looking at the Great Plague of Marseille, or the Plague of Provence, which lasted from 1720 to 1722. I'll look first at some of the ways the plague crisis caused or restricted the movement of people, and then I'll discuss some examples of how this French epidemic set off the movement or spread of information or ideas in Europe and well beyond. Taking place in the Age of Enlightenment, regarded, of course, as an era of mobility, cosmopolitanism, intellectual dynamism, this outbreak of bubonic plague allows us to trace a vast network of movement and communication across the globe. It remains for us today in the form of correspondence, newspapers, petitions, journals, sermons, government documents, of course, and so on, all exchanging information about the outbreak and all containing letters and documents from other port cities. It is this network, traceable in historical archives across Europe, that in fact led me from one port city to another as I conducted research for my manuscript on this subject, the 1720 plague in transnational perspective. It turns out that the plague in southeastern France was a dominant topic in much of Europe and the colonies. Its mention is ubiquitous in the contemporary record. In the end, all of Europe, the Mediterranean, and the colonies in the Americas and Asia experienced social, economic, and diplomatic effects from this outbreak, despite the fact that it never spread beyond southeastern France. And I'd like to stress that point because it stayed within Provence and some neighboring towns. And yet it has this much larger, these waves of ramifications. So let's talk about this plague briefly itself. It was one of the last major plague epidemics in Europe. It entered France through the port city of Marseille in May of 1720. As the story goes, the infection arrived on a ship called the Grand Saint-Antoine that had spent a year in the Levant gathering goods for a major trade fair that took place annually in France, in the south of France. While I should mention this narrative has recently been complicated by a new genetic study, which proposes the possibility that the 1720 outbreak actually had its origins within Europe itself. Nevertheless, for our purposes, all of the archival documents across Europe, in fact, pertaining to its origins, agree that there were infected cadavers on this ship and that that is, in fact, what caused the outbreak. There is little doubt, nevertheless, that over the next 2 years, the epidemic took as many as 126,000 lives in the French regions, provinces of Provence, Languedoc, Auvergne, Le Comtat, and the Dauphiné, modern-day Rhône-Alpes. By some accounts, at its height in 1720, as many as 1,000 people perished in Marseille alone per day. Despite its virulence, however, this outbreak was successfully contained in southern France as a result of measures that were put in place on the ground, not only in France, but across Europe. So what kind of movements did this plague crisis cause? The movement of people during and even after the 1720 epidemic manifested itself in a variety of different ways, so proceeding, I suppose, somewhat in order here. The first thing we see in 1720, no less than upon the arrival of major epidemics both prior to and since the 18th century, is the departure of the wealthy. From the city of Marseille in this case. In the early days of the infection, when movement was still permitted in the region, many headed to the countryside, while others took longer treks to other parts of France. In many cases, for example, those who remained anywhere in Provence or even Lyon or Grenoble, flight would actually not be enough to spare them infection at most, or quarantine at least, since eventually the epidemic would spread all over that region of Provence, and it would cross over into parts, as I said, of Languedoc and Rhône-Alpes. And in those locations, many families also fled to the countryside. So the populations of many cities in France, even those that were ultimately spared in the north and in the west, saw significant decreases in their populations. And while most of these drops were only temporary, in places like Aix-en-Provence, of course, and Marseille, Toulon, it would take some years for the population to return to pre-plague numbers. In these cases, of course, it was not only the result of migration, but also of actual fatalities. Once quarantines and sanitary lines start being issued in July of 1720, however, almost all movement ceased. And it was carefully regulated from this point forward and monitored. But this was a full four months after the outbreak began, because municipal officials, échevins, and members, I should say, of the Bureau de la Santé in Marseille, they feared the effects that a plague epidemic could have on the commerce of the city. It was a principal port city. It has this monopoly with trade in the Levant. So initially, they adopt this policy of denial, one that even involved the paying off of doctors from Montpellier who agreed to declare the outbreak a mere contagious fever. As late as July, in fact, the city's officials were sending letters to the regent in Paris, as well as to health officials in ports all over Europe, stating that local authorities had managed to contain the fever, but this would ultimately prove futile. Despite the artifice of the officials in Marseille and their persistence in hiding the evil, the Parlement of Aix, soon forced to dissolve, interestingly, because of the outbreak, finally recognized that Marseille was undeniably infected with plague, and on July 31st, they issued an arrêt to suspend all commerce between Marseille and the rest of Provence under pain of death. This order served to inform all areas of Provence about the infection and was recalled a few years later, interestingly, in a letter from the Parlement to Versailles, when they wrote, quote, "How many citizens that single arrêt saved Provence? How many subjects, how many subjects were conserved for your majesty?" End quote. A little later, on September 14th, another arrêt followed, this time from the Conseil d'État in Versailles, the State Council of the King, that further cemented a blockade between Provence and the rest of France. And this is when freedom of movement in the region essentially comes to a complete stop. At this point, movement out of Provence beyond the natural boundaries of the rivers Rhône, Verdon, and Durance was severely restricted through the use of strict quarantines and military cordons. This cordon sanitaire, or plague barrier, involved not only city bourgeois militias and provincial levies, but also a quarter of the regular army. Claude Leblanc, this was the Minister of War during much of the Regency, he directed six line battalions and militia to Provence to prevent the plague from traveling north in France. These quarantine lines would eventually result in the plague wall that we can still see parts of, remaining parts, in parts of the region today. Movement, as I mentioned, was restricted on pain of death, so soldiers were instructed to shoot violators immediately, and we do have evidence that this took place frequently, frequently enough for the following comment, at least. In one of many letters, English diplomat Sir Robert Sutton reported to Secretary James Craggs, quote, "The plague has reached Aubagne, Marignan, and other villages, but 'tis assured it has not got beyond the lines, the guards shooting all those who offer to pass them." In the end, individuals who wish to move about would need to obtain certificats de santé. Also, from this point forward, in part as a result of Marseille's failure to properly manage the outbreak in those earliest days, the administration in Paris would step in to deploy military commanders. They intensified surveillance and police presence in the affected infected areas. They placed agents on the ground from the capital, and bestowed them with absolute sovereignty to help manage the plague. They created new health bureaus in Provence that operated under a new Conseil de la Santé. Essentially, crisis management now is founded on an increased dialogue between the Palais Royal in Paris, where the regent now lived, and local officials in Provence. And their efforts were interestingly deemed a success for many decades thereafter in a variety of future plague tracks and texts on commerce that would be published into the 19th century. Interestingly, responses to the threat of infection and movements like this did not only take place in France, but across Europe and the colonies, as I hinted before, as neighboring states issued restrictions to prevent the spread of plague into their own realms. Even before it was confirmed to be bubonic plague, news of the outbreak quickly spread across Europe to cities such as London, Genoa, Venice, Cadiz, Barcelona, Lisbon, and from there to colonial cities like Havana and Manila in the Philippines. All of these port cities and many more across the globe were instructed to mobilize against the threat of plague in France. For European colonial cities alike, this meant, of course, quarantines, but also controversial vessel searches, the use of health certificates, the prohibition of any French ships entering into port, in many cases, even if they had not stopped anywhere in Provence. But in some cities, most notably in Spain and in parts of Italy, protection against infection in 1720 also meant curfews, restricted movement through the use, again, of quarantine lines or certificates of health, mandatory participation in religious processions, punishable by incarceration, banishment, or death, the suspension of festivals or other celebrations, the closure of brothels, so on and so forth. All of this, again, despite the fact that the plague never left France. And in the case of Spain, for example, violations of these new policies were mostly enforced, again, under pain of death, incarceration, and also the confiscation of goods. We can imagine the kind of commotion that these kinds of regulations cause. A good example is in Valencia, in Spain, for instance, where residents rushed in great numbers to obtain health certificates in case they needed to leave the city. Lines formed, quote, from dawn until very late in the evening. In Murcia, Spain, which essentially quarantined itself from the French plague with new mud walls, even though there was no sign of infection anywhere nearby, there were reports of people initially scaling these newly built walls to escape, attempting to make breaches in them, and the punishments for those were severe. In fact, the kind of accounts that circulated in newspapers and letters at this time, they tell of the chaos that emerged from panic-stricken towns all over Europe, which feared the spread, of course, of infection. These stories reveal the vigorous and extensive network of communication that emerged during the 1720 plague involving consuls, ambassadors, governors, clerics, doctors, merchants, laypersons, and others. All of them are writing about the disaster in France and its ramifications abroad. They discuss, for instance, precautions and measures taken against the plague all over Europe, and of course they exchange stories, their own or those of others, about arrests, ship burnings, forced quarantines, the search of vessels and of people, and even the executions that took place on the ground, mostly in port cities, as Frenchmen tried to travel or conduct business while the plague raged in Provence. There were major embargoes placed against France at this time, Provence. One story, interestingly, for example, involved French traders who meant to neglect the embargoes against their ships and force their way on land. In October of 1720, there were Frenchmen who tried to make it ashore in Pisa, in Italy. They were shot and killed in the attempt. The letter from Genoa was printed in a Spanish newspaper, the Gaceta de Madrid, that reads, quote, "From letters arriving from Pisa, we have learned that in the neighboring countryside, four Frenchmen were seen who had landed on the coast. A certificate of health was requested of them, but they did not have one, so they attempted to force their way inland, at which point they were shot and killed and their corpses burned." Another report in London's Appleby's Weekly Journal tells a similar story, but from a different place, from a different city in Spain. Letters from Spain give an account of the desperate condition of several ships from Marseille, which have come upon their coast, and making signals of distress, have implored supplies of provisions by the help of speaking trumpets, but have been refused, nobody daring to go off to carry, go off to them to carry it, or to take their money if they had done it. They give an account that one ship, having been refused as above, landed with 20 men in the night near Cartagena, where they plundered two villages, taking all the provisions they could meet with by force, carrying off as many sheep and cows as their boats could take in, and telling the people that, hey, we were obliged to do so, being not able to get admittance anywhere to supply ourselves by the ordinary way. It's also worth noting that the plague in France arrived at a time in which ideas about contagion and the usefulness of quarantine were very much in flux. This was especially true in England. where a debate emerged with special force in 1720. It took place between the contagionists, who held that quarantining was integral for preserving against the plague, and the anti-contagionists, who argued that quarantine was useless since contagion, they believed, is caused by miasmas, or these poisonous vapors in the air. They were miasmatists, in other words. In fact, the plague in Provence inspired plague tracts all over Europe and North America during the plague years, including the Holy Roman Empire, France, Italy, Switzerland, Ireland, the British colonies, including Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Virginia, and others. Though possibly more plague tracts did come out of London at this time than anywhere else. To conclude, the widespread ramifications of this outbreak have allowed me to trace a network of movement and communication that brings to light the interconnected nature and emerging globalization of the 18th century world. And of course, I've only scratched the surface of this today. In line, then, with this view of the Enlightenment era as one of mobility, dynamism, intellectual vitality, this major epidemic of plague that was successfully contained to southeastern France nevertheless managed to influence people's lives and understandings about the nature of contagion in much of the rest of Europe and the colonies far from the infected area. So what I've tried to do, then, is to examine the kind of movement and shuffling around of both people and information that a disaster can cause, in this case, a major outbreak of bubonic plague. But why is this important? Today we are no strangers to disasters and crises. Almost daily we are confronted with images of catastrophes taking place all over the world, and this is increasingly the case, not only because of our accessibility to information from around the globe, because of TV, social media, but because of the perils of climate change, which is in fact causing extreme events to take place in some cases more frequently, in other cases, as with hurricanes, with greater force. So today, more than ever, it's imperative that we look to history for answers, for explanations, for guidance, asking as many questions as we can to better understand what changes catastrophe can bring and how to best manage them. This includes understanding the causes and effects of the movement of people and ideas before, during, and after a major crisis. And it's especially true in the case of epidemics, since they're so often caused by the movement of human beings. As I speak, in fact, Madagascar fights to manage its worst epidemic of plague in many years. As this outbreak is contained, of course, we should look back and ask, what caused its spread? What did we do wrong or right? What lessons can we draw for the future? Thank you.